of our programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on donate. And now, coming up next on The Boo at 11 o'clock, it's Madness Radio. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, April 1st, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Flash Gordon, the 1980 camp superhero film where Flash tries to save Earth from attacks by Emperor Ming the Merciless of the planet Mongo. Again, that's Flash Gordon, showing Monday, April 1st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm, on the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health, an affiliate of Mad in America Radio, broadcasting on KBOO in Oregon, sponsored by Portland Hearing Voices and the Icarus Project, and syndicated on the Pacifica Network. Madness Radio is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio and at madinamerica.com. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Caroline Mizell Carlton. Caroline is a survivor of psychiatric crisis diagnosed with psychosis. She's the director of training of the Wildflower Alliance, formerly known as the Western Mass Recovery Learning Community, and she's part of the Jewish Renewal Movement and studying to be a rabbi. So welcome to Madness Radio, Caroline Mizell Carlton.
Thanks, Will.
You do a lot of work with the Hearing Voices movement. You do a lot of training around the U.S. and internationally, and you're very much involved in new approaches to mental health and working with people and systems transformations. So it's great to have you on the show and to hear something about your own personal experience with mental health recovery.
Thank you so much for having me, Will. It's really great to be here. So, like a lot of people that get involved in this work and in this movement, what drew me to it are my own personal experiences of pain.
Yeah, maybe that's a good way to start. Do you want to just talk about that and how that maybe led you into the mental health system, and then how it is that you kind of got out of the system and now you've built this life for yourself and this career for yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So I certainly am not originally from Western Mass, where I currently live. I grew up in a place called Indiana. Indiana is not a place where you really want to let your freak flag fly. You don't question authority. Mm-hmm. What was difficult about that for me as a young person was there were folks in authority roles that hurt me. So a lot of what I went through was kind of framed as punishments. For example, I remember one time as a kid, I drew a flower on my hand and I thought it was this really beautiful thing. And I showed it to a teacher and she kind of like flipped out on me for having drawn on myself and started screaming at me like really loudly in front of these kids. And she dragged me into a room and poured like floor cleaner on my hand and started like put scalding water and like started scrubbing it with a brush while she was yelling at me. But, you know, being a young person, I think what was confusing about it was, you know, it was framed as a punishment. So I didn't understand that what was happening to me and the things that I was seeing happen to other children weren't okay. So it made the world feel like this very scary place.
So that happened a lot. That was just one example of the kind of thing that you had.
Yeah, definitely. And so, you know, for me, when I first started having, you know, perceiving things like visions or voices that other people didn't perceive, it wasn't really a scary thing for me. In some ways, they were very comforting because some of the voices that I heard were like adults and they weren't quite as mean.
So you say voices and visions. What kinds of things were you experiencing? It sounds like they were maybe more positive and they weren't threatening at all, but they were definitely perceptually different than the people around you.
Yeah, I remember, for example, hearing this man's voice. I remember hearing him. I was like sitting next to my Big Bird big wheel out in the yard, and I was like watching the woman who had hurt me in the past, the one that I mentioned, and she turned to this other woman, like her friend, like next to her, and she was like, "You know, Maureen, there ain't a cloud in the sky." And I remember really clearly hearing this voice that said just over my shoulder, "They're liars. They're liars. There are clouds in the sky, and I hate them."
So the voices that you heard weren't just kind of like arbitrary. They were very much a response to this illegitimate authority and this punishment world that you were in. They were kind of like allies and standing up for you and supporting you and validating you.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely felt that way. And I mean, things got a little bit harder when, so I'm 36. So when I was 8 years old, it was the time of the first American Gulf War. And it was at that time when things kind of really fell apart for me. And I started having these visions of like green lights. I couldn't sleep at night. I was scared all the time. I would hear like screaming and crying.
Do you think that was related to the war that was going on in the media and people getting really apprehensive about that? And
I think so. And I remember like being that age and like coming to the attention of like a teacher, and she was saying to me, "Oh, we're going to get you some help." And I was like, "Oh, good. Like, she's going to help me like figure out how to stop this war." That she's going to take me and we're going to finally figure out how to make the bomb stop falling, and that will make things better.
Because that was the help that you felt was needed in the situation.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought that was what was going to happen.
But then what happened?
So what happened was I went to see a doctor.
So you went to this doctor, and what did the doctor say? How did the doctor respond when you were eight years old?
What I remember well is that it wasn't long before I had what I call my pill plate, where, you know, I was a kid and, you know, I would go out to the breakfast table and there would be like, you know, my cereal bowl. And then next to it, there would be this plate of pills. So, you know, I got this message, but it sort of continued for the next couple decades of my life that there was something internally wrong with me, but that it had a solution. And that solution, it always came in pill form. So I took medication from a young age and for many, many years.
What were you taking?
Risperdal, Seroquel, some were called like antipsychotics, some were called anti-anxiety. They had all these like anti-names, like that they would take, you know, my problems away. Like they would like the antidote.
So looking back now that you've sort of lived your life and have this different perspective, what do you think was going on? What do you think it all meant? You mentioned the war. You mentioned not having a place for your emotions. You mentioned this kind of punishment that was happening from authority figures.
I don't know. I think for me, a lot of it was this call to heal the world. Like I remember, you know, I was having these visions at one time, and it felt like they really did mean something. They were very specific. Like I was seeing specific people, and at school they were there, but some of them, it would look like they were like bleeding from their head, and I would see this and it was disturbing, but it also felt like, I don't know, like maybe I was supposed to help these people, or there was some sort of problem, like that it meant something. it felt like they needed something from me. But, you know, when I went to the therapist and tried to like figure out, you know, what does this mean? What can I do? You know, basically she told me what it means is you have a neurodegenerative disease. And if you don't take these medications, that your brain will further degrade.
So these visions are pointing in the direction of healing people. And that kind of, it sounds like, became your calling. Your life calling is very much someone who's a, because you're now a teacher and a trainer and a healer and a counselor and a helper in your life now.
Yeah, I work to do that. I work to heal the world, certainly. I think one of the things that I didn't get that I try to hold for people now is that it's normal to feel fear and pain in the face of war. It's normal to have these seasons in our life of despair. It's normal to wander and feel confused. But, you know, it's also something that we don't have to go through alone. I think what I really needed more of was community. I'm old, so like I was hospitalized in like the early 2000s, so I remember like the smoking rooms. And there was something that I never forgot about those spaces, that sense of community. And as I said before, there weren't a lot of people telling me that, hey, there's pain in life. You will struggle. Things like war and rape are terrible and they cause you pain because that pain is drawing you to pull people closer and then hopefully address it together. But I did get the beginnings of that message like in those smoking rooms.
From the other patients.
Yeah.
Do you want to say more about some of the hospital experiences that you had?
Well, there is one memory I have. I remember like I was in that hospital for so long that I was there like throughout Hanukkah. I didn't believe in anything. I believed that life was just sort of pain. But I remember someone asking me, do you want to light this menorah? So when you light a menorah, like on the first night of Hanukkah, there's like this baracha, there's this sacred statement that you make called the Shehecheyanu. And basically it's saying like, it's giving gratitude for like the universe for all that had to happen for you to survive to see this one moment. And it was weird to say it because there were people like some of us that had literally tried to kill ourselves like in the past year. Like one of the patients was like in a back brace because she'd tried to throw herself off of a bridge. But here we were, like we were huddled around this thing and we were saying these ancient words. And I think it was in that moment, and I was definitely in a psych ward and it was definitely one of the worst chapters of my life, where I felt something that might pull me out of it. And in the presence of something bigger, holy. And yeah, that's a moment that I've never forgotten, that I've taken with me. And I feel like a door kind of opened in me as we did that, as we kind of like honored survival, even though a lot of us had come close to not surviving.
So it sounds like that was the beginning of maybe your connection or reconnection to Judaism. Did being Jewish become a resource for your own survival and your own recovery or transformation? And how did that happen?
Yeah, it certainly did in some interesting ways. So religion has kind of become a dirty word and like we don't want to talk about it and we're like, oh, we don't need that. But I see that there can be this profound, almost anti-capitalist rootedness in some of these faiths, these powerful values that are about like sharing wealth, like taking care of the planet, taking care of each other, honoring like the sanctity of human life. So I'm just really excited about the potential of reclaiming some of these traditions and value systems that have been lost and like their healing potential. Sometimes like in liberal culture, we're like, oh, you know, morals are relative and, you know, what's right and wrong really shifts. And we kind of reject like some of these value systems. But I think what happens sometimes is that these other value systems come into that empty space and claim it. What I mean is, like, for me, when I was a kid and I was struggling in that empty space where there weren't a lot of value systems, the medical model sort of swooped in and like put its flag in the ground and claimed it. At that point, like, I had nothing in my life. Like, I had no degree, I had no relationship or children. Like, all I had for an identity was like my criminal record and my psych record. What Judaism and culture gave me was this whole other identity beyond mental patient that I could tap into. I feel like for me, you know, so much of what healing meant was sort of finding an identity, finding a purpose, finding strength and meaning. And ultimately, the mental health system doesn't do a great job with things like identity, meaning, and purpose. I mean, they could provide me with an identity, like the identity was, you know, bipolar, borderline. There were these various identities, but they didn't really provide me with much in terms of strength and purpose.
And the space of not being religious, you could say, well, I don't really worship anything. I'm just living my life. Well, maybe you're also worshiping money or worshiping success or worshiping consumerism. We all have this kind of default value system, and maybe religion just organizes it in a more explicit way. And the secular world also has its own religion and its own mythology, but it's presented as science.
Exactly.
But isn't there also a kind of a dark side of religion that people can get kind of lost in religious beliefs as part of their madness, or they can use religious beliefs in an oppressive and harmful way? There are all kinds of very oppressive practices done in the name of Christianity that are claimed to be grounded in scripture. Like, you have all kinds of militarism and evangelical colonialism that's done to convert the heathens and convert the indigenous people. And so what is it that's in the tradition itself that you think still survives all of that misuse and appropriation for harmful things?
There's a problem that happens when we stop the dialogue. So certainly, you know, when looking at texts that are like 2,000 years old, we need to also be a part of the conversation and say, hey, you know, women weren't really involved in life back then in the way they are now. How do we bring a feminist lens to some of these traditions? How do we bring a queer lens? When it comes to sacred text, always in Judaism, it's about asking questions, kind of like we do in like a Hearing Voices group, right? Like, I think a lot of people in our movement talk eloquently about like open dialogue. I feel like in Judaism, it's kind of like being an open dialogue with your ancestors. Like, you're a part of this conversation.
Yeah, because that is something that's very distinctive to Judaism, the kind of intellectual engagement with the scripture and the discussion and the exploring different points of views. There's an incredible curiosity and conversation that happens that really is emphasized in how you worship. Is that right?
Absolutely. It's very important. I remember once I was like studying like a page of Talmud with this guy, Arthur Kurzweil, an amazing rabbi. And he was talking and he said something interesting. He said, comfort is not a Jewish value, but meaning is. Looking for meaning, exploring, going deeper, looking beyond what's called the pashat, like the literal meaning of things. And I never forgot that. And it's helped me through like my own madness experiences, knowing like, hey, this might not be comfortable. I still struggle. I still have voices that can challenge me, but remembering, like, it's less about being comfortable and it's about finding a space to look for meaning and also, of course, be supported by community as I grapple with that meaning instead of just having the conversation shut down.
There are also a number of practices within Judaism that might, from the outside, look very crazy in a sense. Like there's a whole practice of talking with God, and people might have these kind of wild conversations with something that nobody else is hearing, and express their conversation and be seen quite odd from the outside, but it's accepted as part of the cleaving practice. Is that what that is?
Totally. So there is this story that you read on Rosh Hashanah about this woman named Hannah, who's like going through a horrible time in her life. She's dealt with like all these losses, and she goes to the temple to pray, and she's just like pouring her heart out to God. And this priest sees her, and he thinks that she's drunk, and he starts like being like, "What are you doing, Hannah? Like, what are you doing? You're making a fool of yourself." But Hannah's like, "No, like I'm praying." And later she's praying for a child, and she's given that child. And what people have interpreted that to mean is that Hannah, who's speaking her own words, like in a moment of pain, is actually teaching us how we should pray, that using our own words, like the words of our heart, even if we look strange to other people, that this opens these incredible gates. You know, you were talking earlier about how religion has been used to oppress. I think people have done that a lot. And when they do that, usually what goes out the window first are mystical practices.
So what do you mean when you say mystical practices? Help us understand what you mean by that.
So, for example, historically, like one of the first institutions to pathologize voice hearers, like to say that voice hearing was a result of a disease, was people in power in the Catholic Church, like in the Middle Ages. And the reason that they did that was they didn't want people going around and saying, "Oh, I heard this voice and it was the divine feminine, and she spoke to me and said, we need to honor her more in our ritual." Like the church didn't want that.
They want people turning to the priests for making their decisions about what to do, because it's a hierarchy, and it's an institution that has wealth and privilege and access and a whole authority structure.
Exactly. So another good way to like hold on to that control is to bury some of these practices that encourage like a direct connection.
What are some other examples of stories from the Torah or practices in Judaism that maybe have some lessons for us around madness and mental health?
Yeah, I mean, a great one is Esther. So Esther is a story about someone who uses like revealing some of her story to liberate people. So with Esther, she was not out about being Jewish, and she marries a king. And then this king has an advisor that's like encouraging him to kill all the Jews. And so what Esther does is essentially she's like, "Wait a minute, you know, I am Jewish." And it's this really terrifying moment for her. There's this powerful phrase where she's like trying to figure out, "Do I do this? Do I do this? Do I come out?" Where Mordechai says to her, "Perhaps this is the moment for which you were created." And it like brings tears to my eyes when I think about it. But I think there's a lesson in there about what's really going to create, I think, more dignity for people is if we're more open and honest about these experiences in general. If we can't get past that problem, if we can't start having the conversation and being open, that we're really not going to create the world that we want.
Caroline, are there other stories that you'd like to share from the Jewish tradition?
Yes. There's one last story that I'd like to share. I'd like to talk a little bit about death, because I think a lot of times fear of death can lead to practices and protocols that really backfire. I remember being trained to be a member of a Chevra Kadisha. So a Chevra Kadisha is essentially a Jewish burial society. And so in Jewish practice around death, we don't view death as quite this like and or thing. Like, it's more of a process. It's not like, oh, your heart stops beating, you're dead. There's kind of, in our tradition, you know, like a person's soul kind of sticks around for a little while. And because of this, it's really critical that we treat a person with a great deal of respect and honor, even though their heart has stopped beating and they're not breathing. What I've learned from this process of like sitting with people who want to die and also sitting with people, because in our tradition, we don't leave people alone until after they're buried. Like, you stay with someone. So that has meant like me kind of sitting with someone who's died, you know, for a couple hours, like through the night or whatever. Like, we take shifts, and it's always this really profound experience. You know, I've learned a lot from that, just about the power and the dignity of being there, not trying to fix anything, because I can't fix anything, but like honoring like the holy transition time that I really have come to apply to sitting with people who want to die. And I guess what I would like to see is more, I think a person who wants to die is also in this sort of sacred transitional time. Like, they're a person that they know the life that they have isn't working, but they haven't quite moved on to the next thing. So there's something really important about that state. And it's not about like fixing it, but it's about witnessing it and being there and honoring the dignity and the sacredness of that moment that I think is really important. So that's one of the things that I've learned, and what I would just like to see, and I think spirituality can help us here, is to honor that state more and honor the fact that death will happen to us all. We can't always control it, but that we should be there present and, you know, in a state of openness, awareness, and compassion.
Beautiful. Caroline Mizell Carlton, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thanks for having me, Will.
You've been listening to an interview with Caroline Mizell Carlton. She is a survivor of psychiatric crisis and being diagnosed with psychosis. She's the director of training of the Wildflower Alliance, formerly known as the Western Mass Recovery Learning Community. She's part of the Jewish Renewal Movement and studying to be a rabbi. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health. Madness Radio host is Will Hall. Producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio is an affiliate of Madden America Radio, broadcasting on KBOO in Oregon, sponsored by Portland Hearing Voices and the Icarus Project, and syndicated on the Pacifica Network. Madness Radio is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio and at maddenamerica.com.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Zenith's Tar Sands Oil Expansion Community Forum on Friday, April 5th, from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the City of Portland Water Pollution Control Laboratory in Portland. Second in a series of community forums on Zenith Energy's Tar Sands Oil Export Expansion, this event will supply project background, climate justice impacts, health and safety risks, and ideas for public action around Zenith's oil terminal. A variety of perspectives will be presented. Again, that's the Zenith's Tar Sands Oil Expansion Community Forum on Friday, April 5th, from 6:30 to 9 p.m. at the City of Portland Water Pollution Control Laboratory, 6543 North Burlington Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
My name is Suzanne LeGrand, and today on Between the Covers, we are talking to Carolyn Criado Perez, who is the author of Invisible Women: Data Bias in a World Designed for Men. Welcome.
Hello.
So I have been reading your book, and I have been enthralled, absorbed, and also deeply disturbed by the amount of gender inequality that you document in your book. It's really quite stunning. You talk about and you show how there is gender equality at work, in language, in the images we find when we do a Google search, in medicine and technology and architectural design, even in the temperature in offices. So I'm wondering if, to start, you could talk a little bit about what is data exactly, and why did you choose to focus your book around this concept of data bias?
So, I mean, data basically is any kind of information. I think we think of it just as something that's sort of perhaps relevant to the tech world. It's just about numbers. It is a lot about numbers, but really it's just another word for information. And the reality of the information that we have in the world, from, you know, the information we know about human history, to the information we know about the human body, to the information we know about, you know, how human beings spend their day, how they work, basically everything that we know. That is data, and the vast majority of it has been based on the male body